Act of Isms is all about introducing you to new ways to engage. And we understand that every purchase you make is a vote for what you believe in.
So naturally, we gravitate towards mission-driven companies, which is why we've partnered with Wayakea. Wayakea is a brand built on three values that Act of Isms can confidently stand behind.
Healthy, sustainable, and ethical.
That's right. This volcanic water is naturally filtered through thousands of feet of lava rock, enhancing it with a unique blend of minerals, giving your body an alkaline pH.
Wayakea uses 100% post-recycled RPET bottles, low-emission shipping, and actively participates in regional reforestation, making them one of the first certified carbon-neutral beverages on the planet.
And best of all, for every liter of Wayakea you buy, Wayakea donates 1 week of clean drinking water to those in need.
So if you're going to buy bottled water, buy with Mother Earth in mind.
Go to store.wayakeasprings.com and use offer code ACTOFISMS to get a 10% discount on your first purchase or delivery subscription. When you support Wayakea, remember, you're also supporting this podcast. So thank you very much.
All right, now let's get into this episode.
Let's do it. Hello again, and welcome to another episode of Act of Isms. My name is Tyler Batson. I'm a documentary filmmaker and an activist that spent over a decade proving that peace is possible, even in the most unlikely spaces. Maria is not going to be joining us today. She is out of the studio, but we are heading out of the studio ourselves and headed into the field. This episode is going to take us all the way from LA to Chicago to explore the topic of tribalism. Now, when we thought about this topic, there were a lot of directions we could go in. The fact of the matter is, in the United States and all over the world, we exist in many intersections of tribes, whether that be black or white, rich or poor, whatever it may be. There are so many different ways that we divide ourselves into tribes. The one that's always interested me the most, even since I was a kid, was the division between the LGBTQ community and the church. And if you're anything like me, you've thought to yourself, Jesus seems like a cool dude. Where do people get off saying he hates homos? I mean, because I'm gay and I know we're not here to speak for anyone, least of all Jesus, but I feel like Jesus and I would be buds. So today we're going to kick hate back to hell and meet Jonathan Randall Grant, an artist and theologian from the small Midwestern town of Mishawaka, Indiana, who is helping churches transition into queer inclusivity, rewriting the history of divisiveness between the LGBTQ community and the church. Stay tuned at the end of the episode where we get a little bit of insight to how this oppression started in the first place. Now, let's get to it.
There we are.
Hey.
Oh, hey. How's it going?
It's going well. Yay. Thank you so much for having
good.
Me.
Good. So good to meet you.
It's so cool.
So this is pretty wild that I'm even here right now.
As in Chicago?
Yeah. I mean, we just met on Instagram. We've been following each other for how long?
Maybe a couple years.
Yeah. And then you messaged me and now here I am in your home talking to you about Jesus.
I mean, that's how radical hospitality works.
Oh my God. I love it.
Jonathan stands about 5'11" and at the sprightly age of 33, his lithe frame is thin, like he hasn't gained a pound since puberty. He's fashionable enough to catch your eye, but understated enough to cast a bit of mystery too. And though his circular wireframe glasses would pair well with any Midwestern priest's robes, I pick up more on hipster Harry Potter vibes than Friar John vibes. But this one's a muggle for sure, and he's on his way to becoming a priest in the Anglican Church. Oh, and in case you haven't caught on yet,
you are identifying as a
gay man.
All right. So that seems a little odd to me. I don't feel very welcome when I step into churches in general for the very reason that I know them to be very oppressive spaces for gay men.
Right.
Yet you have spent a lifetime with the church.
Yeah.
And your faith still intact, presumably. How?
Well, for one, like, churches are very queer spaces. There's something very queer about traditional liturgy and who Christ centers in his movement. The purpose of a church is like a communal expression of faith. And that communal expression of faith was traditionally built for people who are outside of the norm. I mean, some of the first people to become Christians were sexual minorities.
Now, if you're still listening, you either dropped to your knees to pray for our queer souls, or you're thinking the same thing that got my ass to book a ticket to Chicago in the middle of winter. What in the name of hippie Jesus transformed churches from queer spaces to halls of hate?
Because of the recent iteration of how church has interacted with sexuality, our relationships between masculine and feminine identities and the way that the church has postured itself in that debate is intrinsically disordered.
This intrinsically disordered messaging has had consequences, especially for queer youth. In a recent study by the Center for Disease Control, research found that youth who lost friends after coming out as lesbian, gay, or bisexual were 29 times more likely to report having attempted suicide. Now imagine an entire community of family and friends turned their backs on you. Then imagine that those people turned around and ridiculed you and abused you. For every incidence of verbal or physical abuse, that child is yet 9.5 times more likely to attempt suicide. You do the math. Churches that do not affirm the sexual identity of all congregants are creating a path to death for young people, all in the name of God. So with the help of theologians like Jonathan, clergy are beginning to set a new trajectory, a trajectory that calls for a return to the queer heritage of the church.
The phrase used by theologians is a trajectory hermeneutic. Some people feel like God set things up and like that's the way it's supposed to run for time eternal. But when you look at the trajectory hermeneutic that he lays out, things are supposed to get better. What is mapped out for us is a like, here's how the way the world is now and here's the world that we should live into. We will be at this place of like radical inclusivity because Christ is always saying that like you've created lines of who's in and who's out. And always, anytime you draw that line, I'm on the outside with the outsider and you're on your own. All of Luke is about this. It's all these parables and stories and time after time where he's just saying like, I'm with that person that you tried to kick out and that you thought wasn't good enough and that wasn't clean enough or didn't match up to your expectations. Like, that's the person that I'm with. That's the person who knows my heart. And sometimes these narratives have been appropriated by the patriarchy, but those symbols are still in there. Like, we're still given that bit of hope and that bit of permission to, like, tear the system down. And that's the permission that God gives us, is say, these systems are creating death. We can tear them apart.
Do you believe that there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it?
A right way to tear the system apart?
Yes.
I think just like in peace building, the way, in my opinion, to do it is the way that centers the most marginalized. To do away with churches altogether, to like remove communal spaces of imagination and of spirituality, it fundamentally harms humans because we need that.
So when you do become a priest, which you seem very excited about, I have to say.
Oh yeah, I am.
Do you think that your role is more as a facilitator for inclusion or as a healer? Or does it have to be both?
I mean, always a hybrid. If I look at what I've been doing already, it's mostly just conversations. I have so many friends who are clergy. And just within the past couple of months, I've met with 5 or 6. One is a youth pastor, and he and his wife have been like working with their youth group at their church in a denomination that's not affirming. And within the past year, they've had 3 of their youth commit suicide over their sexual identity, which disrupts and sends the whole community into grieving. This church is harmful and toxic enough to create this in these ideations in these children. And that pastor in particular, like, he's not going to be able to change the minds of hundreds of people overnight. He's like in the gap with those kids, like trying to advocate for them and their sexual identity and their faith. But there's no one to support the people who are supporting those kids. So I think my role is to just like massage people's imaginations and like remind them that they're not alone in this and that there's endless possibilities of what we can create.
And if you don't mind me pointing out, you are a white man.
Right. Yes. Maybe the whitest.
I won't hold it against you.
Okay.
So obviously your experience is going to be a little bit different.
For sure.
As far as the fight for inclusion in the church.
Enter Michael Vasquez, founder of the inclusive campus ministry, The Brave Commons.
As a person of color and as a queer person, the primary place in which I've experienced racism and homophobia has been in a Christian context.
Can you talk a little bit about some of those ways that you have been marginalized?
I was expelled from seminary just recently.
Why?
For protesting. So for advocating for students at Hope College who invited me to be a part of their protest, who invited me to be a part of their organizing work. And I came
advocating for queer students or
queer students and students of color.
So you were expelled for standing up for the marginalized.
Yes. I was expelled. They called me a terrorist.
Are you kidding me?
No, that was a good time. So what we did, we threw some flyers, some quarter sheet flyers over a balcony during a Christmas concert, which they later called a worship service, but it's not a worship service, it's a Christmas concert. And as of that, people were terrorized.
By paper.
When you have a brown man who looks like how I look, apparently, throwing anything, they feel terrorized, which is literally what I was told in the meeting with my deans. Like, because I look Arab, people were terrorized. That's just some racist nonsense. But hey,
are you angry?
A little bit.
To be honest.
Yeah, I'm furious because I think a lot of the people that there are people who self-identify as allies that work at that seminary that have done nothing. They've done nothing. Progressive Christians don't get a pass. Folks who have the rhetoric, folks who will say things with their mouths but will do nothing with their lives. It doesn't matter if I can say like Black Lives Matter. It doesn't matter because if my life does not reflect that Black lives actually do matter, and these are the things that I'm doing to ensure that these lives are elevated in ways that they have been oppressed, then my rhetoric is just as much trash as a conservative person who's spewing hatred.
Do you or are you willing to assist them in creating those links?
Yeah, I think well, what I've seen is the resistance to systemic change. In faith circles, we're often tied to an unhealthy ego. And it's about like, I still want to be the name that people follow on Twitter. Like, I want to be the person that people come to for advice. I want to be the person that people come to. And yet, in order to bring about changes, like, I need to be able to give over whatever platform I have to these other people who are experiencing marginalization. Like, actually, I want to elevate your voice. I want to center your story. And not center your story by me telling your story for you, but center your story by allowing you to be the owner of your story. Me, as someone who's able to sit here with you and record a podcast, I have to look back and see like who's further back at the end of the line, because I have access to a platform here that there are folks who don't have access to. I have a college degree. I'm upwardly mobile. I'm formally educated. Like I have access to resources. I have privilege that even though as a person of color from an immigrant family who's poor, like, and the 15 million other things I could list that put me in a marginalized category, there are ways in which there are folks who are more marginalized. Jesus is consistently found there, always. I believe that the work that Jesus did was taking on the debt that is owed for the injustice that is perpetuated throughout the world. It is the victory over white supremacy. It's victory over homophobia. It's victory over misogyny. Like, Me Too is central to the work of the gospel. It's central to who the person of Jesus is, which is incredibly ironic, given that so many of these abuses that we hear about have taken place in churches.
So speaking of intersectionality, a lot of the work that you do being both justice oriented and church oriented, institutional, there's an intersection of faith and trust. Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit on what that's like, trying to gain people's trust, but also keep the faith?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I think there's a mix of sharing story and telling story and then hearing story with the students that I work with. I think a lot of the students, they want to hear that I have credibility to speak into the things that we're talking about. Not just that I have experienced these things myself on my own, but also that I've done the work, I've been committed to this work, and I can speak into the particularities of their struggles and I can name them. But I can also name the ways in which I am not as articulate in certain conversations. I am not an expert by no means in the experience of trans folk, but I can create spaces where the trans students and the genderqueer students that I work with can thrive and flourish. And I think that is, those are the places where I've been able to establish trust is by saying, like, I don't actually know as much as I probably should know, but I want to, what I will tell you is, I will go to bat for you. I will go to hell and back for you. And that's evidence in the labor.
We're actually in a church right now.
We are.
We are. Do you ever walk into a church and feel that sort of feeling of I don't belong here? Or is it just straight up defiance? I do belong here and I'm going to be here.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag because I think there are ways in which, as we look at like the stained glass that's right over here, or just like the beautiful architecture, there's a way in which you're like, well, something about this feels like home. Because something about this was supposed to actually be deeply good. Not the building in and of itself, but the art within the building, the people who ought to be gathering in this space, something about the place speaks to a different reality, speaks to something that says like, yeah, there's a goodness, there's a beauty that is inherent to what this space ought to be, right? Part of me is very hopeful for like what things could be and what things ought to be, but also just very sick to my stomach at times where I'm just like, the things that happen here, the things that are said here, the things that are done here, all in the name of Jesus and God and country and kingdom, it's offensive, is incredibly offensive. But I will sit in a place and I will occupy a place and I'll demand change, which I think is so much of what we see Jesus doing. In John, Jesus sneaks his way up into the temple and just sits there in the temple and the pause is just like, you know what's kind of shitty? Like all of this right now. Like Jesus just like in full sass and full just like pettiness. There's a part of Jesus that is incredibly petty. And something about that feels really holy. But he just sits there and he critiques things. He looks at the things that are taking place around him in the temple and he critiques it either very directly or through story, through parable. And he just spills all the tea. And he's like, listen, this place was supposed to be something different. The church that we're in right now, or the churches that I occupy or the colleges and universities that I work at, these spaces were supposed to be something different. And in the spirit of Jesus, I'm going to show up and offend you with my presence because my presence as a queer man of color is an affront to you. And that's good because I want you to feel uncomfortable. I want you to feel like sick to your stomach a little bit. And hopefully that feeling in your gut is going to move you towards change.
Have you seen change?
Have you seen change? That's a great question.
By your approach.
Yes. The thing that I've seen the most significant change in is in the spirit of marginalized students. They develop a sense of bravery, a deep courage, a vibrancy, and that is significant. If that's the only thing I get to see is that the lives of students who have lived in perpetual self-hatred, perpetual self, in some cases harm, depression that comes about from being in spaces that spew hatred, that don't dignify their lives, that move to joy, to passion, to zeal, towards hope. If that's all I get to see in the work that I do, that is significant enough. But also, just because of who I am as a person, I won't settle there. More than anything, as a community organizer, as an activist, as a policy advocate, and all of the things that I do, at the heart of all, I am a midwife of a new creation, and I'm stewarding a new creation into existence. And that is hard. Have you ever seen a labor video? Have you ever been physically present for someone going to labor? Like, it is messy, it is loud, it is bloody, but it's a beautiful process. And at the end of it, there's new life. At the end of it, there's hope, and it was worth it.
Do we have to reach that threshold, though, in order to see change?
I think so. Yes. I think if we didn't need to, we would have seen change by now.
So baby steps are not enough. Because some people want to offer that.
I see what you're doing to me. I see what you're doing to me.
I'm not pushing. I see you're tearing up a little bit.
I think that baby steps can be helpful. Sure. I don't dismiss that out of hand entirely. I am tired, however. I'm exhausted of being offered crumbs by centering privileged, straight, cis, white men primarily, and their fragility and their pain and their story that has been centered all along into like, oh, well, like you need a baby step to get somewhere. In the meantime, while you're taking your 15,000 baby steps, my people are still suffering. People are still going hungry. People are still going oppressed. People are still dying in the streets. So while you decide whether or not to come alongside dismantling police brutality in America, while you're still trying to figure out like whether or not your church can show up, whether or not your organization or your company will divest from the systems that allow those kinds of injustices to be perpetuated, while you're deciding, people are still dying. So I just want you, I want people to know that as they're taking their baby steps, bodies are dropping to the ground in the middle of the street, and they're being left there to rot in broad daylight for hours before an ambulance is called. Circa Michael Brown. That's just one example. And so sure, baby steps can work, but I want people to know at, with each baby step, there's another life that is put at risk. There's another life that is desperate for change. So who is being centered in baby steps for justice? Not the people who need justice, but the people who are refusing to bring about justice.
There are a lot of people of color that are lacking in trust, particularly of our government and other institutions. Yeah. Where do you summon that trust that things can actually change?
That's a good question. I think my faith is rooted not in trust, but in hope. I believe that even in the midst of our darkest hour, even in the midst of the most difficult, most painful thing, that something different can be brought into reality, that something beautiful can be cultivated and created and flourish. I do not have trust in the institutionalized church. I do not have trust in the government to bring about those things. But do I have hope that they can move from the places where they have been for so long into a better place that is equitable, that brings justice, that brings freedom and liberation and joy? Yes, right. I don't trust that in this moment, these systems that have been the causes of so much of the evil that we experience in the world can suddenly overnight become that which will bring about change. But do I have hope that our systems and structures can move in that direction? Absolutely. If I put my faith in trusting an organization or an institution, it will crumble. I cannot have my faith grounded in something that is in a profane way. I put my trust in the sacred because that's how I can have hope. So trust gets dangerous. And I think as pastors, as leaders, we want people to trust us. We want people to trust the movements that we have. And I'm like, we can't expect people to put their trust in us. Like, we have to prove that we are worth that kind of trust. And so in the meantime, hope is all we have.
Would you say you want to make the church great again?
That sounds dirty. That sounds so dirty. I will not say that on record.
Then I'll say it.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Cool, are we off now?
Yeah.
Yay.
That was great. That was a great last question.
This all had to start somewhere, right? The oppression of the queer community. Because as you're telling me, this is not how it began. You know, everything is a little topsy-turvy.
Yeah.
To use a delicate little term. I don't think anybody has ever described systemic oppression as topsy-turvy.
Right, but it is like...
Yeah. But I mean, how did this start? Like, do you have any idea of the historical relevance of oppressing the queer community?
There's a lot of support for starting it with the trial of Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde was like intensely beloved in Britain and the United States as a public intellectual writer figure. And he was caught having sex with the son of a lord with whom he was also romantically connected, which was a major affront to English culture and to American culture. It was a shock to everyone. That started a movement. I mean, when you look at hymns in Britain and the United States before the trial of Oscar Wilde, you have these amazing, like, sensual, homoerotic descriptions of Christ. You're like, I come to the garden alone while the dew is still on the roses, and he walks with me and he talks with me and he tells me I am his own. And in visual art too, Christ is depicted as very effeminate. And that was completely accepted, that like Christ would be somehow this effeminate, queer, non-binary.
Almost in the way Hindu gods are depicted.
Exactly, exactly. And after Oscar Wilde, you literally have Teddy Roosevelt saying, no, Jesus was a butch man. He would have punched them in the face. He would have like been rough riding with me. He
really?
Yeah. And you have this shift that we still bear the remnants of today. Like people were so scandalized by Oscar Wilde's trial. I mean, before that, of course, homosexuality, homoeroticism, it was ingrained in the church and in our understanding of God. And when Oscar Wilde was tried, oddly enough, what made it a criminal offense, what made it wrong and immoral, was not that he was having sex with another man. I mean, to be a bit crude, it was that he was penetrating the Son of a Lord. Like he was acting outside of the what was viewed as a proper power dynamic, as he was just like a commoner. That being so public somehow kicked off this catalyst of fear and of like separation.
So would you say that the oppression of queers actually started as a class war?
What God lays out in the Bible is that in Christ, there is no male nor female, nor Jew, nor Greek, nor slave, nor free. Like we are all equal. And it's taking a long time for us to actually live into that. It doesn't make it less true that we haven't done it yet. It just makes us human and flawed and terrible people.
Well, I want to meet some of the good people that you surround
yourself with. Oh, yay.
Because I understand that there are a lot of people here in Chicago in particular who are helping to bring these two tribes together, the church and the LGBTQ community.
Yes.
So would you mind introducing me to some of them?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, I'm really stoked for you to meet Emily McGinley and Tim Wolf. And
I'm gonna have to write all these down.
And Alicia Crosby. Yeah, these are all some really like passionate, empowered voices who are on the ground creating theology with their lives and bodies and advocating.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I got a lot of work to do.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
Cheers.
And thank you guys so much for tuning in for another episode of Act of Isms. And stay tuned for next week's episode, where we explore more of the history around queer exclusion and oppression in the church, and how people like Michael, like Jonathan, and so many others are working to correct the trajectory to equality and inclusion. If you guys haven't already, please subscribe, like all of the things on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and iTunes, and wherever you find your podcasts. And if you guys want to and you like what you're hearing, please leave us a review. We love you guys, and thank you so much for the support. See you next week.